Blog Talk Radio.
Geeks United is on the air tonight. Hope everyone out there is having a great weekend. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. I'm having a great weekend. Thanks
for having a good one. How's your weekend, Jerry?
It was good. You know, thanks, man. I've just been outside reading all day out in the sun, so, you know, I'm really happy.
What you reading?
I'm reading David Carr's memoir, Night of the Gun. He's a New York Times columnist. And you know what I just read before that? You know what I finished yesterday? Because I spoke about it last week, so it was a good... David Carradine's The Kill Bill Diary. So.
Oh, the diary, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and that's just like...
Interesting.
It's interesting. I have to say, if you read that, and if you were reading that, or if you read anything by him, or even read an interview like a week before all this happened, you'd be like, this doesn't sound like a guy who would, you know...
No.
Yeah, so...
No, but by all accounts, he was like a real raconteur, endlessly entertaining... you know, they said you could talk to him for hours, and he was just so full of life and full of stories. And
Very full of stories. That's what's really sad about all this.
Yeah. We have a great show tonight. Actor Rufus Sewell is on the show this evening. Wonderful actor. He's going to be talking about his new film, Downloading Nancy. And then about 15, 20 minutes from now, movie geek Chris will be joining us, and we'll be talking about the latest happenings in movie dumb.
Movie Dumb. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Including Michael Moore's latest. There's a preview out for that now, a kind of teaser of sorts.
It's a teaser. It's fascinating.
Yes. And speaking of no less fascinating, the tracking for Transformers 2. We'll be talking about that a little bit.
Are we going to talk about Megan Fox's interview on Entertainment Weekly?
Sure, we can bring that up too. Sky's the limit, man.
All right, that's awesome. That's what I love about this show.
It's freedom when the three movie geeks get together. It's fun talk.
It's awesome.
Anyone out in the chat room that wants to participate in tonight's festivities, obviously you can chat away with the comments. And also you can call into the show at 718-508-9477. Mr. Sewell is a pre-recorded interview as part of a press junket for his film Downloading Nancy. So obviously he won't be taking calls. But I appreciate everyone tuning in tonight, either live or on the archive. And let me tell you about this Downloading Nancy. A really powerful, shocking, surprising movie about marriage, about obsession, a little S&M thrown in there for good measure. Always benefits from a little S&M.
Yeah, it does, and I think you're this film's strongest champion, so go for it. So, I'm not saying because of that, because the reviews I've read haven't been as good as yours, so you got to champion this thing, man.
Hey, I know that I watched it not even seeing a preview for it, which I think benefited me because there's a turn that it takes halfway into it that the preview reveals, which unfortunately...
Oh, really?
We're about to play the preview. So,
okay.
That I had no idea of. I was going in completely cold. There are more surprises to be had from the movie, but it's a real kind of discovery. The movie surprises you, and we talked to Rufus about it during the interview.
Okay, cool.
That element of it. Rufus Sewell, of course, a great actor, done a lot of terrific movies like Dark City and Hamlet. The Illusionist, yeah, on and on and on. Great career. And this is a very specific role for him that he found very exciting and challenging. Here's Rufus talking about his new film, Downloading Nancy.
Where's Nancy?
Nancy's in Baltimore with some friends.
Who has friends in Baltimore?
You are a beautiful woman. What's in your head right now?
Let me take that.
You don't think I can handle it?
I don't know. Can you?
Is that a daisy?
My 10th anniversary present from Albert.
It's not like her not to call.
It's good to be away from each other.
Be very careful. You're on the verge of stealing my breath away.
Wow. Are you going to add me to your collection?
You're getting your very own shelf.
Well, what's the real you?
What's the real you?
I am the real me right now.
Come on now.
Like that.
So if we do this, it'll be the end of everything, you know.
That's the whole idea.
Looking for a Nancy Stockwell? Server maintenance?
What are those?
These are the emails.
No, that's not Nancy.
But all these emails seem to indicate that she is in a very intimate relationship.
Would you do me a favor? Would you kiss me? Nice, like?
See, what you don't know can't hurt you. Do you think that's true?
Shut up! I don't know what you thought you were going to do coming into my house.
You realize that love does not mean hurting someone, right? Oh, such a load of crap. You want to make love to me?
This is real.
You can't love me!
I know you. I know you.
Aren't you going to need this?
Why don't you say we stop this game now?
When you received the script, what were your first impressions?
Well, it's very, very affecting,
mm-hmm.
very unusual, not the kind of thing you normally read. But I was struck by how powerful it was and how uncompromising. And also, I thought it was very well written. And I was very pleased by the fact that the part on offer to me was not something you'd obviously... Well, I mean, personally, I think, you know, there's nothing, no type of part that I feel closer to or further from. But in terms of the kind of things I often get sent, I have to wade through a lot of the same kind of offers. And for me, this very emotionally kind of underqualified, middle American, beige-wearing, golf-obsessed guy... You know, I was very, very pleased to be considered for it. Not that it was the most flattering of offers, but I found it very unusual and just a kind of, it was so different from anything I'd done before that appealed to me very much.
It was very much, and that's what I was thinking as I was watching your performance, that this was a role that I don't think that you've tackled before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an arc there, too, to this character, when that kind of sheen of reserve kind of cracks for this
yeah.
character. What else can you tell us about Albert and your approach to it and possibly your conversations?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I've never played the same role twice. And one of the problems, you know, all people in their careers have different things they have to surmount. And for me, what it's become... it changes, but at the moment, or over the last few years, it's the fact that I've played, you know, one kind of role, and people considered that was my forte, and that's very much not the truth, you know, so people would associate me with a kind of villainous or a kind of lordly, or
mm-hmm.
which the things that at the time were real stretches for me, no more than anything
mm-hmm.
else. I mean, this part for me is certainly no more of a stretch than anything else I've ever played, because I don't have any particular strengths, other than possibly comedy, which would surprise most people, but for me... I kind of empathize with him quite a great deal, purely because he was someone who coped with the emotional demand put on him by being with someone who's very damaged.
Mm-hmm.
You could say it in a very bad way, that he just can't cope with it and he shuts down. And he's not trying to be cruel to her. He just can't deal with it. So he just overlooks her pain to the point that she just becomes an annoyance to him because he's just not equipped to deal with it. And,
right.
you know, we've all had similar experiences to much lesser extents, you know, in relationships, and I could identify, you know.
Yeah. When
the only thing is that I don't really like golf, but, you know, other than that.
when you watch the film, obviously having gone through the process of making it, when you watch the finished product, did anything about it surprise you?
Well, it surprised me. No, I mean... No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, we pretty much knew what we were doing. I mean, it's, you know, the relentlessness of it. You know, we were very uncompromising in our approach, you know, mm-hmm. and at the time, it's not like anyone was... No, I wouldn't say I was surprised. I mean, I was... you know, the film was very affecting to me and quite, you know, and quite bleak. And I imagined, I think of it as funnier than people seem to think. Because, you know, especially the way I was working with Jan, the director, that a lot of my timing, though it wouldn't come across, was comic. You know, I found Albert quite funny in his way.
Yeah.
You know.
It is very funny. And what's odd, what's strange to me and unique about the film is that it's genuinely surprising. It takes some very surprising character turns. And I'm always so thankful for movies that surprise me.
Exactly. Well, that's what I think rang true about it. That, you know, I can't say it rings true because I've had similar experiences. But I think that when any character disembarks from what, you know, the cliched, you know, track that you expect it to go on, then it seems closer to life because people mm-hmm. don't... I mean, funny thing is, people do try to perform along the cliché, but people learn from television and films as much as anything else, that people try to enact patterns that they've seen before them in films, because people go through life rather clueless, you know. So in times of tragedy, and stuff, people behave like they see in films because they don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm,
but
yeah.
when things go off that track, you know, and people behave in a surprising way, I always find it more truthful.
That's
yeah,
very true.
Yeah, me too. And I'm sure you've gone to festivals with the film. Have you attended?
The only one we went to was Sundance.
Well, that's the one to go to.
That's the big one. That's one of the big ones.
Was,
you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, well, I was working at the time. I was doing a play on Broadway. I was doing a Tom Stoppard play called Rock and Roll, which could not have been more different. I've gone straight from playing Alexander Hamilton in John Adams, like literally overnight. I was on a plane and then I was playing Albert the next day. So,
yeah, you were fantastic.
Like
that was an awesome role, and that's I think it helps also because I don't think anyone could typecast you. It's just so many different roles in a short amount of time.
Yeah, well, not for want of bloody trying, though.
Yeah, I know.
The only power I think I have, really, I mean, I'm determined to take it as a compliment because, you know, every role that I find myself in being typecast is something that I've done in order to get away from a previous typecast, you know.
Right.
Yes.
There
yes.
was a time when I left drama school when I was very frightened, believe me, of being stuck in kind of comedy. Well, that's what I left drama school thinking, that would be my danger. And then as an experiment to get away from playing hunchbacks and assorted, you know, kind of comic weirdos,
mm-hmm.
I did an experiment of trying to play a romantic kind of a Byronic part in something, and I got stuck in that for a while, because that's what
mm-hmm.
people thought I was like. For a while, I was only getting offered Irish parts after I did translations on Broadway and Man of No Importance with Albert Finney, and
mm-hmm.
then I got stuck playing bad guys and then kings for a while, so I'm determined to enjoy the limits of a new typecast.
Okay, fair enough.
Exactly.
Comedy
exactly.
transvestite, something.
I'm wanting one more question about your Downloading Nancy experience, and I'm not sure how much interaction the actor has with the cinematographer, but the DP of
this... case, a great deal. Chris Doyle was very, very much working. I mean, that was what's wonderful about working with someone, and I think what is incredible about him is not just how beautiful the images are and the light, but the fact that you feel he's a partner with you in the scene, because the camera's handheld, and the fact that he would move in and out and with you according to the energy of the scene, and his
mm-hmm.
ability to read the temperature of a scene and know where to put the camera and how quickly to move in, I felt he was like acting with a little kind of helping angel or devil or whatever, but somehow you were aware of his presence in the scene with you, but he never went against the energy of the scene, and he just became quite, you know, I found he was like a almost like an acting partner.
Yeah, yeah, and his films, his photography feels like that. Christopher Doyle,
yeah.
amazing talent.
Another reason
that I'm a fan of his is because he had special platform shoots when he was filming me. So we called him Christina when he was filming those. He had these fantastic glam rock stilts that he wore so he could have a different perspective because, you know, I'm a little taller than him.
Yeah.
That made me feel very special.
Now, when you started out early on, when you decided that acting was the path you wanted to take, who were those actors or artists that inspired you most?
Brando had an enormous impact. But so did Charles Laughton and Anthony Hopkins, the early work of Anthony. I mean, obviously the late work is still great, but it seemed to be no end, not only to the kind of roles he can play, which, you know, I feel the same way about myself, to tell you the truth, but in terms of people allow them to, you know. So for me, that's something I'm quite belligerent about. There are examples when I look at Finney and Olivier, and I know I'm aiming high, but what the heck, and Anthony Hopkins and Brando and all the great, great actors are just actors. They're not types.
Right.
They're not held by any kind of character type or kind of genre or any milieu or whatever. They can dance between them, and that's something that, succeed or fail, I want to succeed or fail aiming for that.
Yeah. Terrific actors such as yourself and a lot of the ones that you just mentioned, they do maintain a career on stage as well.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the stage gives you that film does not as an actor.
Well, to a certain extent, the stage gives me the kind of roles that I haven't really had the opportunity to play in films. I mean, that's why there's a dangerous game that one is tempted to play with fame, because I have learnt that the one thing that stops me from getting near the roles I really want to play is a lack of that kind of fame. So one could not be hankering for that kind of recognition, but at the same time, what it does seem to get you, good or bad, whether you can play the roles or not, is a shot at great roles. So it's a very dangerous, it's a difficult, you know, tightrope walk, that one. Because
yeah.
I certainly like the benefits career-wise of that kind of recognition, but I wouldn't want it walking down the street. So I think that the only power I have is my power to brace myself for periods of unemployment, i.e. what I say no to. But just say, so far in theatre, if anyone tries to offer me a role that is, you know, based on something they've seen me do before, it's very, very easy for me to say no in theatre, because there's absolutely no reason to be typecast.
Right.
No reason at all. There's no reason I have to put up with it. Whereas
right.
there's a certain, or has been a certain element of, well, you know, if I want to be in The Illusionist, I can play the bad guy, or I can not be in it. And I certainly wanted to be in it, and I had a great time doing it. But, you know, I personally would like to have had a crack at any of those roles, with the possible exception of Jessica Biel's, because I don't think my head is saying that kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
Do you have any ambitions to direct at all?
Not really. I feel there's so much more for me to do as an actor. That, you know, I've got so many ambitions that I don't feel I'm anywhere near in terms of what I'd like to do. I mean, I've been more inclined towards producing, actually, because that way I can actually probably get closer to making the films that I want to be in. Selfishly.
Right.
That's what a lot of actors have done. Like Sean Connery did that early on. He had more control.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what's upcoming for you?
There's the possibility of a very large miniseries for a company that's could be very interesting. And what I like about that is it's finite, and then potentially ongoing for years.
Yeah.
And possibly some theatre next year, and possibly a couple of independent features. So I'm very happy about the variety.
Okay, that's Rufus Sewell. The movie is Downloading Nancy. It opens up, it opened up June 5th, so it's out in select theaters now. It's also available on demand services on your cable.
I have a question for you. I have just because of the look of the film, and it is the cinematographer is Christopher Doyle, who's probably one of my favorite cinematographers. How does the film look?
Oh, you're stricken with that automatically. And actually, I noticed in the opening credits that Christopher Doyle was the DP on it, so I was looking out for it. But
okay, I mean, does it? So it stands out for you. It stood out. A lot of things, the images and scenes stood out for you because he's
it's a very, very distinctively framed movie, and he's right when he says that camera. It's like another character in the piece. And it's a great looking movie, and it's being billed as the most controversial movie of the year. I'm sure Antichrist will be the next. But yeah, it is a very.
I think you're right about that.
Yeah, it is a very shocking movie, but also very true to the characters.
What I was curious about, and you'll forgive me, I'm not trying to take up any time or anything, but it's just something that I wanted to address that he had said early on in the interview. He had brought up a really great point about how we think about movies, and he had said something along that we frame our lives in movies, how we react to things. And I just found that very fascinating that he would brought that up. I mean, I just thought, wow, you know, someone's actually going to bring that up. But he's a very fascinating individual. I was really impressed with him.
I think movies do that.
Yes, they do.
Pop culture does that. And I think that, you know, obviously television is the major pop culture influence now. But I think cinema and the size and the shared experience of cinema is powerful, too, in that way.
Yes, it is.
Chris.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, how are you, Chris?
I'm doing great. Just listening to some of the interview with Rufus Sewell there. Man, I love him.
He's a good guy.
You do like him.
I don't know, absolutely. Ever since, I guess the first time I really noticed him was Dark City. But I like him in everything. In fact, when I first heard his voice, I was immediately reminded of his character in The Illusionist. He was real good enough.
He
does have a great voice, though. But as I was listening to him, I was thinking about it. The name Rufus, that's one of those things. It's got to be. It's either you are like, either you're like very British and very posh, or you're like some backwoods Alabama, redneck. It's one of those names.
Rufus. No middle ground. No middle ground with that.
Yeah, a lot of range.
It's a major cross to bear. Okay, I want to talk about some of the new topics around the movies lately. New stories. So Chris, welcome. And thank you for joining us also.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor.
It is my pleasure to be on the show always, and I mean that.
Thank you. And we had a great Heat tribute. Hey, I'm thinking about other new classics to pay tribute to.
Well, you know what? We talked about one the other night that made me, and just the mere mention of it made me go watch it, and that was Casino. So
yes.
I could put my hat into the ring for that movie.
Oh, totally.
What do you think about Seven?
Oh, that's another one.
I mean, those are both winners. I mean,
the thing is, it's a testament to Heat that we can do a show like this and we can talk for an hour about all kinds of different topics. But Heat is a movie that we can talk for an hour or more on just on that one movie. You know,
right,
we don't.
Yeah.
It's not even like we had to try very hard. Like,
no,
just,
we didn't.
Such a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, we rarely try very hard anyway.
Oh.
No kidding. Let's talk about this Michael Moore thing. In select cities, including Washington, D.C., near you, Jerry, they had a special teaser trailer shown before, I think, Pelham or something. And during or after the preview – well, let me play the preview first, and then my explanation of what occurred after the preview will make more sense. Here's a little teaser of Michael Moore's new film. I think it opens October, dealing with the economic fallout here in the States.
Hi, I'm Michael Moore. Instead of using this time to tell you about my new movie, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to join me in helping our fellow Americans. The downturn in the economy has hurt many people. People who had no choice but to go on government assistance. Yet our welfare agencies can only do so much. That's why I'm asking you to reach into your pockets right now and lend a hand. Ushers will be coming down the aisles to collect your donations for Citibank, Bank of America, AIG, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and a host of other needy banks and corporations. Won't you please give generously? Now, I know what you're thinking. I already gave at the bailout. And I know you did. But even if you've given in the past, give some more. It'll make you feel good.
Okay.
I need to add something. We didn't get the preview when we saw Pelham. I was just praying that Pelham would not break down when I saw it, okay? So we didn't even get the preview for that.
Okay, that's valuable information. So after the preview played, actually volunteers with tin cups saying "Save our CEOs" walked around the audience asking for donations. It was the first taste of a publicity stunt for the film. So that's his new topic, certainly very timely. And I don't much mind it if he can't find out any new information. Because, you know, Hamlet's not new, but a dramatization of Hamlet is new. The treatment of that material is new, in a way.
But I hope he interviews, like, he interviews a lot of people all over the country, different people in different regions. That's what I really want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I really want to hear. I don't want to just hear, like, the talking heads. I want to really, for Michael Moore, for me at least, that's what I liked about Sicko, is he went all over the place.
Yeah, and I don't think he has much tolerance for talking heads doing their talking head thing.
No, but this ties into what Bill Maher was talking about at his, if anyone watched Bill Maher the other night, you know, he really let Obama have it the other night.
Yeah, yeah.
And that ties in with what's going on right now, so.
So, Michael Moore, I guess the big question is, relevant topic, Michael Moore still relevant, Chris?
Yeah, I feel the same way as you do. It doesn't matter if he doesn't get new information, you know, for this movie. He didn't have any new information for Bowling for Columbine or Fahrenheit 9/11 or Sicko. There was no real new information here, not just his movies, but I'm thinking about, you know, documentaries like Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. These are all topics that somebody
went and made.
Well, it's common knowledge, but they're all very complicated. There's all a lot of pieces, and what Michael Moore does and what the makers of that Enron movie did so well was sort of put them all into a digestible piece.
Right.
Because I'll be honest, like the economic situation, like I understand all the pieces when they're explained to me, but it's very hard for me, and I consider myself to be an intelligent guy, to put them all in perspective and sort of lay them out. You know, it's like a big puzzle, like. And I think Michael Moore is, you know, maybe not the perfect guy to do this because he does tend to skew the issues sometimes, but I think he's as good as anybody, really. Like, I mean, I think he'll make a really interesting movie.
Well, and plus this is close to his heart. I mean, he came out of the gate at the beginning of his career with something, like Roger and me, something that deals intimately with part of this crisis with the automobile industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the person. I think he still, you know, matters. And it's not even so much a digestible format, Chris. It's just he's a populist. He has a way of getting people whipped up into shape, getting them interested in going to see a documentary. That's not something a lot of people have. Maybe a Morgan Spurlock to a lesser extent. But if you want to get people, and this is a situation that's not going to end anytime soon. It doesn't matter that there's not any new information. We're talking about a recovery that's still like 2 or 3 years away, to be very honest with you.
If not more, by some people's estimate.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, there's no, what was it, even though one of the people on the economic team, you'll forgive me, I don't remember what the name was, but he said, these are just false dawns that are happening. There's no real progress just yet. And it will be. It might not be till a second Obama term that there's any real progress. So, he's the guy to do this. Michael Moore is the guy to do this. Still,
here's the dichotomy. Go ahead, bud.
Sorry, I was going to mention. I don't know if people are going to want to go see it because the thing was, when Sicko came out, and in fact, I think we had this conversation when Sicko came out, and it seemed like perfect timing there. It seemed like a movie people really had it's the exact movie for the exact time. And I thought it was a good movie, but nobody really went and saw that movie, and it certainly didn't get the kind of reaction that Columbine did or Roger and Me or Fahrenheit 9/11. So I don't know. I don't know if people are going to want to go. I think maybe this is another one of those topics that could keep people away from the theater. Like, oh, God, like, I want to go. I can turn on the news any time and hear about this.
Yeah,
you know?
But if you release Sicko today, it still wouldn't do well because now we are actually going to have the debate finally.
Yeah,
and
I mean, but that could have ongoing currency, that movie.
Yeah.
But here's the dichotomy. And by the way, if anyone wants to join in on the conversation, we're going to be talking about a lot of things in the next half hour. Not all serious political things. We're about to talk about Transformers 2, for crying out loud. So come on. The number to dial is 718.
Is Don Murphy going to call in?
I'm going to make Chris talk about Transformers. 718-508-9477. Just give us a call and put in your 2 cents. Here's the last word on Michael Moore, and it'll be mine. Thank you. Here's the dichotomy with him. the issue should be the star of the movie, but his career and his films have taken such a shape as his public persona that he is the star of the movie.
Yeah, it's unavoidable.
Yeah, so there's obviously a backlash against him. He's not like some anonymous filmmaker making an expose. He's front and center in all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's ultimately helpful or hurtful in the long run.
Let's put it like this. I mean, if Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Nickel and Dimed and who covers this kind of topic in her writings, her journalism, if she did it, it wouldn't be... You need a Michael Moore because he has the name. He's a brand. Let's be very honest. He's a brand.
Yeah.
He brings that. You need him to do this if you want people to go, if you want to fill seats and get people aware.
Yeah. Here's another interesting trailer that came out this week, and this will be our next topic.
Give you a briefing about the institution?
All I know is it's a mental hospital.
For the criminally insane.
We take only the most dangerous, damaged patients. Ones no other hospital can manage.
You are hereby required to surrender your firearms.
We are duly appointed federal marshals.
But during your stay, you will obey protocol. Gentlemen, welcome to Shutter Island.
Marshal Daniels?
Doctor. So this female prisoner, Rachel Solando, escaped sometime in the last 24 hours.
She considered dangerous?
You could say that.
It's 11 miles to the nearest land and the water's freezing.
We don't know how she got out of her room.
Came back for a midnight round, she was gone.
It's as if she evaporated straight through the walls.
Who is 67?
There are a total of, 66 patients at this facility?
That is correct, yes.
Well, it seems some Rachel Solando is suggesting that you have a 67th patient, Doctor.
A lot of people know about this place, but no one will talk, you know? It's like they're scared or something.
You haven't taken any pills, have you? Seen any walking nightmares lately, Marshal?
I've built something valuable here.
Don't you get it?
You're a rat in a maze.
Valuable things have a way of being misunderstood.
Who knows about this?
Everyone.
The nurses, the orderlies, they couldn't possibly know.
Everyone. You do understand that they can't let you leave.
Going somewhere?
Shutter Island, the new Martin Scorsese movie. The trailer for that came out, and I just lost Chris's line. Perfect timing. The new Scorsese movie, I think it opens October 2nd.
Mm-hmm. They're going with The Departed there. You know, they want to recreate everything. You know, get the timing right, everything. That's, what
yeah, that's right. That's his new month.
Yeah, so, so far, I'm very excited. I can't complain with what I saw in the trailer. It's a very different novel from Dennis Lehane, not his usual crime, Boston crime novel thing. So it's very intriguing, but I'd say it. I think when Scorsese and DiCaprio have gotten together, it's magic. And it's not just DiCaprio. I mean, this thing has a stellar cast.
Yeah.
Mark Ruffalo, Ben Kingsley, Emily Mortimer, Michelle Williams, Max von Sydow, Jackie Earle Haley, I mean, and Patricia Clarkson. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
And Ted Levine, I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, Max von Sydow in a Scorsese flick. That's good.
Dude, I mean, that's just an incredible cast.
Chris, what were your impressions? You saw it, I take it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw it, and it looks freaking fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's one of those situations where the preview gives away so much information.
Mm-hmm.
That not only do I not want to see another preview, I don't want to see that preview again.
It's a lot there. I mean, that's the problem with these previews the last couple of decades. They do give away a lot.
And I know that's not, that's probably not Scorsese's fault. You know, there's probably some marketing team that's doing that. But it's just a big pet peeve of mine. And yeah, in the last couple of years, it's gotten so bad. And this one is no exception. But having said that, you know, the movie itself looks very exciting from everything. And it's just like every Scorsese movie in the last couple of years, too. When it was announced, like Jamie, you and I have talked about it lots of times, when it was announced, the project never sounds really that interesting. But as soon as we see a glimpse of it in the preview, all of a sudden I'm on board. I'm like, wow, this is not what I had in mind when I read about this piece.
It looks extraordinary. I mean, the photography itself looks extraordinary. And it looks like Scorsese back in kind of, this isn't a downplay of his gifts, but back in like almost B-movie territory. It almost feels like William Castle territory in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminded me of Cape Fear a lot, the preview, actually, visually.
Right,
anyway.
Right.
Yeah, by
the way, for people that think that that's a put-down or something, Departed, Scorsese meant to be his B-movie. So when we're talking Scorsese B-movie, we're not
talking about what many people wish their A-movies would look like.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah. Not to change topics, but Drag Me to Hell is one of those. Like, that's a B-movie. But it's a damn good B-movie. It's a B-movie that any filmmaker would, you know, cut off one of their testicles to have made. You know? I mean, it's made like that. And Scorsese, yeah, Departed falls into that category. I think Cape Fear falls into that category. So, and in a strange kind of way, Goodfellas and Casino fall into that category in a very strange kind of way. Not completely, but I
know what you're saying.
Some of the pleasures that are taken from that movie are very E-movie type pleasures. You know, you're watching all these awful things take place, and it's very, you know, you can't turn away.
So you like Drag Me to Hell, Chris?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see it right when it came out, but I did go and see it with a friend today, and it was very, it's kind of hard to explain. It's partially what I expected, it's partially not what I expected. I mean, it's like a haunted house going
into the
movie.
But you had a great time.
Oh, I had an incredible time.
That's what everyone says. I mean, you just have such a good time watching the film.
It really is like a haunted house, like one of those cheesy haunted houses that's put on. You know it's fake, and you know it's corny, but the corniness is what's so exciting. And you watch the whole movie with a smile on your face, and it does have really great scares in it. And the great thing about it being directed by Sam Raimi is he doesn't do the easy scares like other horror directors do. He doesn't give away the scare that's about to come with the framing or with the music or with, you know, something else like that. A lot of times in a movie, just by the framing, you can tell that there's a scare that's about to happen, even if you turn the sound off. Sam Raimi doesn't do that at all.
Or if the girl has a cat, you know that when the cat jumps out, the next thing that jumps out will be the killer.
Right.
Right. Well, actually, that's a good point, because this girl does have a cat in this movie.
She has a cat, all right.
And what happens with the cat? not what you expect, believe me.
No, it's not something that PETA would appreciate, huh?
No, it's a really, really fun movie. And it has an ending that I thought was actually, in a strange way, one of the more ballsy endings that has been made in movies in recent years. Like, I mean, it is in a B movie. It's in a little fluff piece like Drag Me to Hell. But it's ballsy. Like the way he tacked the ending on is very, very. It shows some chutzpah.
And you don't really expect. You really don't expect that. You really do think, wow.
Yeah.
And then
boom. It doesn't do what you think it's going to do.
Yeah.
It's a great time.
He is very. He's compatible with Scorsese in a way in this genre, because when you think of Sam Raimi going to the horror genre, as he lived in the beginning of his career. You think of him being such a free talent in intoxicating camera moves and just almost like drunk on the whole experience of making a genre movie, and there's such adrenaline in it, and so this is a real return for him to that earlier mode of filmmaking, and now he's going to go back to anesthetize himself with Spider-Man 4, so it'll be done.
Well, maybe Spider-Man 4 won't be as bad as everyone thinks. Sorry.
We lost Chris again.
Oh, man.
But that gives us an opportunity to talk about Pelham, because neither of us have seen Pelham. Hang on. Chris, you're back.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on. I've never had this problem before, but for some reason.
Sinister forces are at work.
You can't keep it up, Chris. I understand.
Yeah.
So, Pelham, Jerry, you saw Pelham.
Yeah, I saw Pelham. And You know what? It's not as bad as everyone makes it out to be, but there is one really bad, two actually, really bad things about the movie. First of all, Louis Guzman, who's in it, you wouldn't know that from the trailer, but he is in it. He's just poorly misused, but Travolta's not really that great of a villain this time.
He's in Broken
this
Arrow
time?
Mode, isn't he?
No, he's not. He's better. Let me tell you this. You will appreciate him in Broken Arrow and Swordfish more than you would in this movie. But who's very good is Denzel Washington. So you have him to root for. Who's surprisingly good, not surprisingly, but he's just so restrained, is John Turturro. He's not like his usual wild self. He's actually very restrained. But who's very good as the Mayor Bloomberg stand-in is James Gandolfini.
Right. That was the part that interested me the most. That was the part that could have been outwardly revisable from the first film, because that was too over the top in the first film.
Here's the thing. I was thinking about this while watching it. All the film parts that Gandolfini has done since he started playing Tony Soprano, I never think of him, even though he is so, that's what he's always going to be remembered for, Tony Soprano. He takes these parts, whether it's The Mexican or The Last Castle or The Man Who Wasn't There, and this film, I don't think of Tony Soprano at all. I think of James Gandolfini playing, the actor playing this part. It was surreal almost. That character, that iconic character, never weighs down his performance in these post-films, and he's just, there's something about him. He has screen presence, and he's wonderful to behold. But I think the film is worthwhile seeing just for Denzel Washington, but Travolta, and once you realize what the character's motivations are, you're just like, who cares?
Mm.
I mean, I just, but it's all right.
I feel like they're not going to put that on the poster in quotes. Who cares?
No, of course not. And you know what? We don't sell the movies here. I don't care what the marketing does, but this, Travolta, and I'll say it right now, he needs De Palma or Tarantino to give him a really great part again.
Yeah.
He really does.
And with Tony Scott directing, and this is mostly two people talking from a great distance.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, does Tony Scott tone down his usual pyrotechnics?
No, they're there on display. But I'm in the minority here because I think that their best collaboration with Denzel Washington, Tony, is Man on Fire. I'm not a big fan of Crimson Tide.
Man
on Fire is, for me, the four collaborations is the one I really gravitate towards. So Crimson Tide I was always disappointed in.
Wow. I adore that movie.
Really? I thought the acting's good, but the story itself never interested me.
Okay. So Tony Scott, somebody that makes Michael Bay look like he doesn't have ADD. Deficit disorder. I forgot to put that last initial on ADD.
Tony Scott is the thinking person's Michael Bay. Michael Bay is never made anything as good as The Hunger, True Romance, or Man on Fire. So there you have it.
Okay, there's hope. What was that?
What?
I'm sorry. I was choking on hope.
Okay. Chris, let's talk about your favorite upcoming film, the one you're most looking forward to seeing. Transformers 2. Here's what's surprising.
I'll come down and see that with Chris, because the commentary will be worth the price of admission.
Yeah, he and I are already going to catch it that preview Thursday screening.
I would be physically removed from the theater. not because I was talking. I would just never stop vomiting once the movie started. So
it's like, what's that vomiting medicine? What's it called?
Syrup of Ipecac. Yeah,
Ipecac. It's like a good big dose of that for Chris.
Yeah.
Okay, it's tracking to be not only the biggest movie of the summer, which kind of I don't doubt,
but a bigger
opening than The Dark Knight.
Really?
It's tracking it like It's tracking well over $100 million for an opening weekend.
Is John Voight in this one, too?
I know where this is. Yeah, because the young people just...
They all just changed everything. No, I just curious. Is John Voight is in this one as well?
I really don't know.
I just want to know if John Voight's in this one is in. What kind of anti-Obama poison is he going to spew out?
I know. And I would say that John Voight, yes, he's in this as well. And no one is actually, as great an actor as he is, no one is actually going to see Transformers 2 for John Voight.
They don't even know who the fuck John Voight is who's going to see this.
What? Are you high, dude? What are you doing?
No, do you even think they know who John Voight is? The people going to see this film don't know who John Voight is. They don't even know who John Turturro is, for that matter.
Right. You're right. I mean, all they know is Megan Fox.
Megan Fox, and they're hoping for another midriff shot, okay?
Right. Well, even so, that's enough to make you $100 million in 5 days. That's the thinking.
Is that what we're going for? Is that the formula for success now?
Hey, you know, hasn't Megan Fox's backside always been the same formula for success?
I know they're hoping for that for Jonah Hex and Jennifer's Body.
Right. So, obviously, the three of us, it's not our cup of tea. Jerry, I know you'll go to see it.
I'll go to see it because you know what? I like my Winchester, and I'll probably sneak my Winchester. No, I'm joking. It is what it is. It's a dumb movie. Even Megan Fox in this interview in Entertainment Weekly said no one's going to go see it because of the acting, because it's not about acting. It's about robots. We all play second fiddle to that. Yes, she has even said this. So,
right.
Not that I, you know, the other movie that I've seen her in is, what was that, How to Alienate and Lose Friends or whatever. But she is very aware. She said, look, you know, women are sex symbols. We're commodities. That's all we are in the business. So she's taking advantage of this. But no one's going to go see this for the acting. They want to see robots fight each other. That's what it is.
Yeah. But that just surprised me. I mean, that surprised me that it was tracking so high. And
does it really? Does that surprise? I'm surprised that surprises you. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm like really shocked. I mean, that you come on, your sarcasm and the cynicism that makes Danny DeVal what he is.
I sense the world buzzing about The Dark Knight in a way that I don't sense him buzzing for Transformers 2. Seems odd to me.
Oh. I do. When I went and saw, I forget what it was I saw the other day, and there was a Transformers 2 preview attached to it. And afterwards, like, I mean, I could hear people all around me with that, like, giddy excitement. And I don't understand when I'm watching it. You know, it's like a 2.5-minute preview. It opens with, like, 60 seconds of just explosions and robots doing robot karate on each other and whatnot. And then, like, cut to a shot of sweaty Shia LaBeouf screaming, get out of there, and then, like, the rest of the preview is just, like, more robots and explosions. Like,
I think I couldn't really say it summed up the trailer better. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, and people were buzzing around, you know, about it. Like, I mean, I don't get it. But,
so, is Public Enemy the first victim of Transformers 2?
I don't know about that. Like, you know, counter-programming, it works out really well sometimes for littler movies. And I think Public Enemies is maybe the kind of movie that could do really well. Who knows?
I think Public Enemies is what the public is clamoring for, personally.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not going to be Transformers, but...
No, but, you know, it's...
I mean, I know I'll be going... That's what I'll be going to see that weekend.
I mean,
I'm not going to be going to see Transformers, so...
No, but
Public Enemies is not...
Speak after, and that's really the film I think that a lot of people can relate to. I mean, just a couple of things, you know, the times and everything we live in. But, you know, let's face it, robots fighting each other, you know, I don't know why. You know, you can go play a video game that has the same effect, if not better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know, like, why go see it? They're just going to keep making them. They're just going to keep, there's no need.
But Don Murphy said the same thing on our show. We'll just have different people in them.
Well, it's true. I mean, they're just going to keep making them. You know, like, they're doing it right now. They're working up another Spider-Man movie. They're working up another Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Yeah. Did we lose you again, Chris? Did we lose you again? Hang on. No, he's still here.
Okay.
He might not seem to know that he's still here, but Chris, you're still here. Okay. Also, and now he's gone. Polanski, I was mentioning, mentioning Gandolfini earlier. You know, Polanski's scheduled to do the God of Carnage on for film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which just picked up all the Tonys for Best Play and so forth.
That will. I look forward to that.
Yeah, another kind of in a room, couples, combustible situation over a long stretch of time. Very Death of the Maiden as a comedy. Even though I'm sure Polanski probably thinks of Death of the Maiden as very funny.
I think on his, yeah, from his end, and it's, yeah, I'm speaking of counter-programming and everything. We have witnessed something this summer, a performance that we on this show probably should promote.
Okay.
And that is Maya Rudolph in Away We Go.
You've seen that?
I have seen that. And I think it's something that needs to be talked about because I don't think people know what they're getting into. It's very easy to dismiss the film as a lighter but still bleak meditation on marriage and relationships from Sam Mendes. Mm. But her performance is just out of this world incredible. You were just really transfixed by her. I guess a lot of people are saying it's like, you know, Will Ferrell should take foreigners, but people forget that Will Ferrell was very good in two seriously minded movies, not so outright comedy, Stranger Than Fiction and Winter Passing. And as an interview in Entertainment Weekly brought up, she sort of skipped Stripes and everything to do her Lost in Translation, as far as Bill Murray's movies are concerned. And this is basically her Lost in Translation. And it's an incredible
movie. But to be fair, Maya Rudolph doesn't have a film career.
No, she doesn't have a film career. And that's
like Bill Murray established.
No,
her Lost in
but
Translation.
That's what a lot of people brought. She just, out of the gate, did this. And
right.
it's very unexpected, but a lot of her own personal biography is in the character. And if you know that biography and you watch the film, you're like, wow, this is a very honest performance from her.
I bet she would be very captivating in it.
Yeah.
I like what I've seen of her.
Yeah,
and
it's a good, it's actually, I mean, it's not a stellar movie, but her performance makes it really worthwhile, and just the how she reacts to John Krasinski, I think from The Office, is her co-star. He's good, but she's really just like wonderful to watch in this.
And here you are, and Chris, even you now, because you're going out to movies now that you're done with school, and yet I still am a shut-in. And I still
you're not a stud, you're the hardest working man in Hollywood.
except I'm not in Hollywood.
Hollywood, Florida.
Right. And I just got around to seeing Last Chance Harvey earlier this afternoon. So that's my big new film that I've seen. And I loved it. I loved it. Just a great... And dealing with themes that I love. Themes like the need to connect to someone else and that one person that you don't know that could change your life. And it's a really sweet, lovely movie. And it's one of those movies that's exactly, you know exactly what it is before you go see it, but it's in the pleasure of watching these people carry it off.
Especially the two of them. I mean, they're just incredible.
Yeah. Hoffman just has such an ease now. And Emma Thompson, she's authentic. I mean, she's the real deal.
Oh, she is.
Yeah, it's a good movie. Chris, and I was, it was funny because I was talking to Chris, and I was laughing so much even after I got off the phone with you because I said, man, I haven't been to the movies in forever. And Chris said, well, these are movies that you don't necessarily have to catch in the theater. And I said, yeah, I'll catch them at home video. And I guess that was too antiquated a phrase to use, home video. And he said, yeah, right, home video. Why don't you don't have to get in your automobile and go to the picture show to see these. We'll wait until they come out on reel to reel. Funny, Chris.
Well, I mean, it is true. Like, there are some good movies in the theater right now. Up and Drag Me to Hell and
The Hangover. Star Trek.
Star Trek. Maybe Star Trek and Drag Me to Hell are definitely two movies that would benefit from seeing in the theater. But you can enjoy those two movies just as much on a good television, a good home video system like you have there at your house, Jamie. But, you know, I know that you are a little bit more selective with the movies that you go see in a theater, and I trust that you will be going to see Public Enemies.
Yeah, I got to see
that. I think we all will be. You know, that's the one to go see.
I got to see that in the cinema. It's so weird that Now here we do. We have this movie show, and I very rarely get out to the cinema, you know, to the picture show.
I want to say something about what Jerry was saying a little while ago about what Megan Fox said about, oh, we're just sex symbols in the industry. That's all women are. And that kind of stuck in my craw. I hadn't heard her say that, but it doesn't surprise me that she said it. It's interesting that we started talking about, you know, Emma Thompson, and I was thinking about, you know, people like Meryl Streep and Kate Winslet and Kate Blanchett and all these kind of actors. Like, I wonder what their reaction is when they hear her say something like that.
Well,
you know?
She says that like they're a commodity. I mean, she's like saying that's what we are.
I think it's just absolute nonsense from someone who, frankly, is possibly not a terribly good actor,
whose midriff is her claim to fame. That one shot, even the article says that one shot of her, looking at the car under the hood or whatever.
Yeah, she
is her claim to fame.
She is the Shania Twain of film actresses. Look at
somebody like Charlize Theron or somebody like Angelina Jolie. I mean, these two women, or Kate Blanchett. They're all, pardon the expression, but like smoking hot, you know.
Yeah.
Like they could very easily have just taken a succession of roles, like, you know, like the kind of roles that Megan Fox took. But they decided, and that's not to say that they didn't. All of those actresses have taken, you know, maybe a role like that where they're sort of just the hottie. But for the most part, since then, since they got their foot in the door that way, they said, all right, well, now I'm going to wait and I'm going to do stuff that is important to me anyway. You know.
And Chris, she makes, you know, she mentions that, and she says that she doesn't think of herself. She would never even, because people compare her to Angelina Jolie, and she feels very embarrassed by that comparison. But let me just take it up a couple of notches. Not just her, but it's her co-star in this film. And I have no idea how to pronounce his name, Chris, but you know.
I think it's Megatron, right? Megatron?
Yeah, Megatron, or Shia, or Shia, or whatever, Shia LaBeouf. And you have such fond memories of him in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Bless your soul. But, you know, I read an interview a couple months ago in Playboy with him, and I just wanted to smack the shit out of him. Because he's like saying, well, you know, I'm, you know, all these things. And he really hasn't done anything. You know, he says, like, I can, you know, have any woman I want. You know, I go to all these parties and everything. He's just as annoying as she is, I think.
There goes our chance to book Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, well, no, you can just edit that out. Don't worry, Shia. We're not going to have him on the show.
I personally think Shia LaBeouf is very good, and I would have
said that, Jamie, before this interview I read, but he comes across as such a spoiled, no different than Megan Fox does. It's just like, wow.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to me. I don't go to pay to see him in a personal interview. I go to pay him to see him perform a role in films, and some films he's been very good. You know, and I'm sure he could get any woman he wants.
He's
young
really,
and rich and successful.
He's just a really spoiled, like, I don't know. But look, Spielberg loves him, so what do we know?
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah.
And I think that Chris is right. Like, Megan Fox, I think it was probably a quote she gave to try to be provocative and seem like she has a real take on where things are, and that's just her reality, because that's the reality that she accepts.
Well, that she accepts, and that thus far she is making for herself, you know, very easily. And it's true, she hasn't made a whole hell of a lot of movies. Maybe we should wait to see the new Diablo Cody script
I would say definitely to see these two films before. But people like really harp on every word that she says. And yeah, she's got this movie, this big summer movie, which she'll be the first to say, look, no one's going to see it for the acting.
Right. Okay, we got some good shows coming up. This Wednesday, we look back at the summer of 1984 with Peter Weller and Catherine Mary Stewart. She was the female lead in Last Starfighter. And, of course, Peter Weller was Buckaroo Banzai. And we'll be talking to Keith Ulick about Purple Rain and all the other great movies for that summer. Also, our friend Aaronauta Diaz, he's having Summer of 84 retrospectives on the Tuesday and Thursday around our show. And then we'll have Bill Pullman and Julia Armand next Sunday night for the first half hour, talking about the new Jennifer Lynch movie Surveillance. And then, Chris, I hope you come back on so we can talk about more fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. We can. Please take a slight moment to mention to Bill Pullman that Zero Effect is one of my favorite movies of all time. And
yeah.
That is by far my favorite performance of his of all time.
It's a great performance.
I'll do that. Hey, you can sit on the phone with me if you want. You can tell him yourself.
I would love to.
All right, dude. Let's set it up, man. All right, guys. Thank you so much. And we will see you back here Wednesday night.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Night. Bye.
Thank you.